Labor Day, Monday, September the 5th, was aptly named. Crescendo of work from 9 in the morning till past midnight. We helicoptered out to the National Airport about 10 and flew out to Detroit with a full contingent of Michigan and Ohio congressmen. It was an hour's change in time, so it was only a little past 10:30 when we arrived at Wayne County Airport. And at the very foot of the steps, who should be but Governor Romney. According to the paper, he had out-hustled a pack of Democratic politicians to be at the head of the receiving line, along with Senator Robert Griffin. He was very courteous, and I consider it a mark of good manners to meet the president at the airport. Lyndon promptly took him in his car on the ride to Cobo Hall, and I rode with Nancy Williams and Congressman Vivian. But not until we had covered the fence, shaking hands with everybody we could reach, and Lyndon had said a few words. However, to me, the whole impression of Detroit is of a town satiated with political figures, too sophisticated to really care if a president visits. It's a long tradition to go to Detroit on Labor Day, and it is said the Labor Party in its heyday could turn out a crowd of 100,000 in Cadillac Square. That heyday is long past, I think. There was no parade today, or if so, it was over and left few echoes. There were scattering of people along the street, no great turnout, and Cobo Hall was respectably full, some 5,000, the paper said. I really enjoyed seeing Nancy, a lively, charming woman who took a job as wife of the man in charge of the African desk in the State Department, in dead earnest, knew every one of the wives from the African countries, and still hears from them, even has visits from them. It's interesting to remember the segment of the Democratic Party in which I lived in Texas and knew best looked upon Walter Reuther and Soapy Williams as a way-out ultra-liberal branch of the party. And in the years since I've come to know them, I like them both very much. Mayor Kavanaugh was quite in evidence, and cheery former Governor Swainson, and Senator Hart, and Senator McNamara's widow. The whole meeting was a tribute to his memory. A newspaper man told me later that the proverbial crowd for the Labor Day speech in years past had been mostly brawny men in blue shirts and women in ginghams. Now there were almost no blue shirts. Nearly everyone had on coats and ties and looked prosperous, though there was a great diversity in the faces before me, even spelled out in some of the costumes of the countries from which the ancestors had come, Poles, Czechs, Lithuanians, Greeks, and a sizable sprinkling of Negroes. I noticed in the back of the hall the Stop the War banner, and then a scrambling as policemen gathered around the small group that had it and began escorting them from the hall, while I hoped that the TV cameras would stay trained on the platform, satisfied in their hope for battle by the presence of Romney and Griffin, who had, I thought, rather discourteously been placed at the very back of the platform and were not introduced. And when Lyndon mentioned Governor Romney's name, a courteous expression of pleasure that he came to meet him, he was roundly booed, to my discomfiture. There was one lone heckler on the left remaining who interrupted Lyndon's talk of a few minutes with shouts of, "Let's settle the war in Vietnam," and his neighbors around him began to hush him. And then suddenly, right in the middle of the speech, Lyndon departed from his text. I think he picked it up from the text of a later speech with the statement, "Those troops will come home, those bases will be turned over for constructive peacetime purposes as soon as that communist aggression stops. And I may add, to all whom it may concern, if anyone will show me the time schedule when aggression and filtration and might makes right will be halted, then I, as president of this country, will lay on the table the schedule for the withdrawal of all of our forces from Vietnam." He did it with fine theater. The reaction was a thrill to watch. The great hall responded as one man. Everyone rose to their feet in a prolonged cheer that laid to rest the heckler for the rest of his speech. I rode back to the airport with Nancy and Secretary Wirtz and a young and very attractive freshman congressman named Ford and Congressman O'Hara. Sophie is still resting after an operation for kidney stones. And with all our troubles, I had the decency to be properly thankful that Lyndon has been blessed with good health. Nothing was ever so tense as the time in the 48 campaign when he lived through a speech or two with the severest kidney stone pains, then had to face whether to have a prolonged operation or not. We had a hurried bite aloft on the 30-minute flight to Battle Creek. Advance men in planning these trips don't regard meals as a necessity. and you get absolutely ravenous. And here was an entirely different picture. The airport was jammed. There was a holiday mood. Everybody was smiling. The arrival of a president was something to be remembered. I believe it had not happened in a good many decades. There were an estimated 65,000 people along the way to the Battle Creek Sanitarium, and nobody more thrilled than I. I had been here 42 years ago, when I was 11, with Aunt Effie, for a rather long stay at the Battle Creek Sanitarium, where she was a patient, and I just came along because she wanted me to see something of the country, and there was really nothing else to do with me. The reason for the speech was to celebrate the 100th anniversary of this health center, famous in its day and still functioning. Memories rushed through my mind of the great white building and its park-like surroundings, of Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, pink of cheek and quick of step in his 80s, bicycling around, always dressed in a very white suit, or conducting early morning calisthenics where everybody gathered out in front of the building about 7:30 before breakfast. Vitamins were one of the biggest words in the vocabulary of the sanitarium, and they were brand new to my world then, and I think to most of the people. Sunbathing was a very important part of the regime. Cereals of all sort, mostly whole grain, dry or cooked, we had in great variety. And since then, so is the whole world. He was a pioneer indeed, Dr. Kellogg, and therefore unpopular with the medical profession, who considered him by and large a quack. Oh, that's my memory of 40 years ago. I remember sitting in the great dining room and hearing a ripple of excitement run through the crowd. There goes Senator La Follette. There go the owners of the Ringling Brothers Circus. A lot of famous people came here in that day. Not surprisingly, it was smaller than I remembered. Things usually are 40 years later, but very much the same. We talked in front of the main building on a platform, and the grounds were jammed with people. The director of the institute gave me my own admission card. Dated in 1923, it showed that I'd actually spent 2 months and that I'd returned again 2 years later, that Aunt Effie had been some 5 times. And this time I made my small speech with assurance and pleasure. After saluting Battle Creek Sanitarium and its 100 years, Lyndon talked of the health achievements of his administration and of its aspirations to give to the world the knowledge we'd learned in combating disease. The freshman congressman he'd hoped to help, Paul Todd, was at our side every moment, but there was no direct plea to elect him, just praise for his good work, as Lyndon had been doing all along with the members. We were late, we put on steam, we raced through the interior of the sanitarium on roller skates. This I regretted. I would like to linger. And then we hurried back to the airport with a short ride to Dayton, Ohio, which only last week had been boiling with enough racial unrest to bring out the National Guards. There was no sign of it when we arrived at Cox Airport, where about 5,000 people were lined up along the fence. I later heard that some of them had waited as long as 8 hours, and the school band had been playing briskly for an hour before we arrived. Lyndon and I were first off the plane with Governor James A. Rhodes close behind him, and always at hand the congressman he hoped to help here, Rodney Love. He talked, we shook hands. Senator Frank Lausche, that authentic maverick of the Democratic Party, met us and went with us the rest of the day, a real barometer that Lyndon stands well in Ohio. We drove to the Montgomery County Fairgrounds, where there was a huge, good-natured crowd. The holiday atmosphere prevailed everywhere, and today is a case of it gets better as it goes along. With Lyndon's enthusiasm rising in direct ratio to the crowd's enthusiasm and size, some prize steers were lined up for us to see, Polled Herford and Black Angus, and then we were on the stage, facing a grandstand jam with people, and between us and the grandstand a solid mass of humanity that flowed on up to the left. Lyndon's talk was on youth and the need for all young people to enter public service for some period of their lives. Suddenly, in front of us, out in the mass of humanity, a banner went up, Thou Shalt Not Kill, and we could see scuffling around a small group with the police moving in and linking their arms around them. Later, I heard that there were about 35 of the protesters. From time to time, they let out a chant, Bring the Boys Home, or Peace in Vietnam. But mostly, they just stood facing the police, a swaying backwards and forwards, like a strange sort of dance. The people around them announced their hostility by raising banners, Hooray for LBJ! Every time the protesters shouted, or by breaking into extra loud applause whenever Lyndon reached a good point in his speech. I could see that several of them were long-haired and bearded. The next day, I read a very thoughtful editorial about their behavior. Their revolt happens to be almost totally negative. It is a sterile thing. It's a frantic effort of some of today's young to find a tangible method of revolt against the velvet prison of affluence, conformity, and isolation. Merely to be bizarre in strategic spots gives people a lot of exposure in this day of saturation coverage of major events by television. As a result, many of the young confuse it with action. They think they are doing something when they are noticed by the TV cameras. I rode back to the airport with Mrs. Love and Frazier Reams. Mrs. Love ecstatic because the crowd had been estimated at as high as 75,000. And we flew to Columbus, Ohio. And then began what was actually the crescendo point of the day. We were already an hour or so late, and we started driving to the Fairfield County Fairgrounds in Lancaster. I rode with Congressman Love and John Bush and Mrs. Muller, the wife of the congressman from that district. Dark was falling, and it had been a long time since our light lunch. The airport itself was crowded, but it didn't end there. It was a solid mass of people along the streets, and Lyndon stopped again and again and again, even in the dark, getting out of the car, using the bullhorn for a few words. As soon as he came to a halt, people began to run pell-mell toward his car. I would put the window down and smile and shake hands with the people that stopped and stuck their heads in and says, "Is that Lady Bird?" But one had to be very careful, because when his car picked up and started, ours had to start at once. Window must be up and people safely back. Night was deepening and the stops mounted 8, 9, 10. I asked Jerry to go up and tell him that we were 2 hours late, and I didn't want him to get exhausted. I didn't make a sale. We stopped the 11th, the 12th time. I heard a message over the intercom from the advance man at the Lancaster Fairgrounds. "Sir, the crowd's been waiting 3 hours and it's beginning to rain," in the most plaintive voice. Still, we stopped 13th time, 14th time. Once I heard over the intercom, "Is there a Dairy Queen place anywhere around?" "No." Then an urgent plea to have something waiting when we reached the grandstand at Lancaster. I could have eaten anything. I could imagine how Lyndon, who had poured energy, words, smiles, handshakes, out into this mass of humanity for some solid 10 or more hours, needed the lift of some quick sugar. Next day, the paper said, he was their kind of president, and they were his kind of people in Central Ohio. Finally, at last, we reached the fairgrounds. It must have been approaching 9 o'clock, some 2 hours late, as we rolled around the racetrack up to the speaker's stand. I was moving like an automaton, but Lyndon was still exhilarated. One newsman said, if Crossroads, Ohio was his meet, Lancaster was the president's triumph. Mm-hmm. And indeed it was. The applause was wild. The people were all smiling. It was a magnificent climax to the day. The rain even miraculously had stopped just before we reached the fairgrounds. The garden club ladies presented me with a bouquet that was a real work of art. Once in the middle of his speech, there came a swift burst of rain. Nobody moved from their seats. It stopped within about 2 minutes. As far as we could see, there were people in all directions. There were 26 school bands. The congressman's wife, Mrs. Moeller, leaned over to tell me. At last, the day was over, and some 2.5 hours behind schedule, we were back in the cars headed for the airport. It had been an hilarious day. Not the least was having such political opposites as Walter Reuther and Senator Lausche in the plane together, and the presence of Governor Romney and Governor Rhodes, which Lyndon accepted gratefully and gracefully, but which threw the newspapers and some of the Democrats into a twitter. Finally, weary, elated, we were on the plane. I felt like a vessel into which more scenes, people, emotions had been poured than it could hold, and I was running over. But it had been a triumphant Labor Day, and instead of depleting him, I have the earnest feeling that it is actually an injection of confidence and strength for Lyndon.